The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm your host, Don Crow. Mere Christianity, The Chronicles of Narnia, The Screwtape Letters, The Four Loves, The Abolition of Man, The Great Divorce. The list goes on and on. His works of fiction and nonfiction are as well read today as ever. Yet it's been over half a century since C.S. Lewis died.
Probably more people read Lewis now than ever before, because I do think that he has been able to place Christianity in a way that really captures people's hearts and imaginations and knows the grandness of it.
In this special edition of The Christian Outlook, we'll revisit his life and his enduring impact. We'll hear from his stepson on the story behind Mere Christianity, born in the context of World War II, and the earlier war that shaped both him and J.R.R. Tolkien.
Talking to young men who were going out to die, to give them some form of hope that that was not final, some understanding of God himself, and how their potential death that evening was not the end of them.
We'll look at the personality of the man so many have found attractive.
Here are these two men. They survive the trenches of World War I. They meet at Oxford. They become friends. And then they go on to write these epic tales of heroism where war is at the center of the thing.
All this and more. I'm Don Crow, coming to you from the nation's capital, where each weekday afternoon you can hear my program on WAVA and across the country on WAVA.com. C.S. Lewis died on November 22, 1963. Yes, a date in the annals of history that he shares with none less than John F. Kennedy. Lewis himself did not think that his literary contribution would be long remembered. So it's a particular irony, then, that C.S. Lewis remains not only read, but one of the most read Christian writers today. In recent years, the very talented Max MacLean has brought to stage some of the classic works of Lewis. He was a guest on my program to talk about C.S. Lewis's somewhat unexpected early success with the Screwtape Letters, the short volume of letters from the demon Screwtape to the novice demon Wormwood.
As I recall from reading, as so many of us have, about Lewis's work and reading his work early on, I learned that this would not have been the book that he would have picked to make him world famous, but it really was one of the first to bring him to international prominence, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I mean, that's what put him on the cover of Time magazine. That's what made him known in this country. He was known in Britain because of the broadcast talks, which later became Mere Christianity. But I think it was the genius of creating this morally inverted universe where up is down, good is bad, God is called the enemy, Satan is called our father below, and to be able to sustain that. And I think what Lewis was doing is, of course, he was echoing St. Paul, who writes, "We must not be ignorant of his devices. Satan masquerades as an angel of light. And therefore, we have to guard against him. We have to guard our hearts. We have to put on the armor of God." But what's interesting, at least for me personally, in doing this book and in working on this, is that the motivation to guard my heart against spiritual warfare has really increased because Lewis's imagination, his imaginative work, captured my imagination in a way that hadn't been captured before.
The book, of course, as we know, was written way back, I think, in the early 40s, wasn't it?
Yeah, 42, I think.
Yeah, why is it so resonant with people even today? Why is it so appealing to today's quote-unquote modern audience?
Well, there's so many reasons for that. One is Lewis has a huge brand, and his embers are blazing now. He wrote just before he passed away. He went to see his estate planner, and about putting his affairs in order. And the lawyer that was handling it asked Lewis, what about your literary estate? And Lewis said, 5 years after I'm gone, nobody will read a word I write. That was not the case. Probably more people read Lewis now than ever before, because I do think that he has been able to place Christianity in a way that really captures people's hearts and imaginations, and knows the grandness of it. And then, of course, Screwtape is one of his great literary creations, because he's the person that is trying to ruin everything, and in the process of ruining it, he actually makes it even more profound. You know, it has this kind of reverse effect on it. And I also think there's tremendous fascination with the idea of personal evil. You know, why do we do the things we don't want to do, as Paul writes in Romans 7? What is it about our old nature that just has so much sway over our lives? That's all part of what makes the Screwtape Letters so popular now. I do think what makes Lewis so special, is probably very few people in history were as well read as Lewis from a literary perspective, in the sense that he was a literary critic and a historian, and he read from the Greeks to the moderns everything. And his memory was so prodigious that he could remember everything he wrote, and he could put it all in and synthesize things. Plus the fact his own spiritual journey from atheism to paganism, he dabbled into the occult. That scared him very much so, and made him go the opposite way, where he studied philosophy and came to believe in the God of the philosophers. But he said, this God is, you have all the benefits of theism without anything to fear, anything to obey. But then he went from there to theism, and then finally to full-orbed Christianity. And when you look at that spectrum, what's so good is that he really understood the mind of someone that doesn't believe and could write for that person. And that's why he used such imaginative works, and that's why he uses satire, and like the Screwtape, it's so, so effective.
Now, as I understand it, again, he dedicated this work to his good close friend, J.R.R. Tolkien, and I guess Tolkien had expressed to Lewis himself some concern over getting too deeply into this whole realm or craft of evil.
Yes, in some ways it's quite ironic, because, Tolkien probably did not want him to publish it or write it. And then when Lewis published it and wrote it and published it, he dedicated it to the person that didn't want him to write it and publish it. But they were good friends. And Lewis admitted that, it was not... He said it wasn't fun, at least not for long. He thought it would be in the beginning, because he wanted to teach the psychology of temptation from the other point of view. But because he was such a generous writer, that the material that he wrote about was his own bouts with temptation. And to dig that up was all, he said, dust and itch and scratch. And after a while he said, I'm not going to do this anymore, I'm going to stop. Because people wanted him to continue writing. The first year it was published, the book went through 8 editions. It was so popular.
In the midst of World War II, with air raid sirens, bomb shelters, and casualty counts rising, C.S. Lewis delivered a series of broadcasts on the BBC. I'll let our next guest tell the full story. Douglas Gresham is the stepson of C.S. Lewis, the biological son of Lewis's late-in-life marriage to Joy Davidman. Gresham was a guest of Jim Daly and John Fuller on Focus on the Family, a program you may well have heard on many of these same stations. Let's pick up their conversation as Gresham explains the story behind the work that would later be known as Mere Christianity.
What happened was that during the Second World War, as I'm sure you know, there were many young men about to go off to battle, and particularly in the Royal Air Force during the Battle of Britain and so forth. And someone came up with the bright idea that there should be a lecturer going around who could really explain these things and talking to the airmen and the pilots on RAF stations throughout England. And they selected Jack to do this job. So he would get in a train and spent most of the early part of those days in trains at night, bitterly cold usually, travelling from RAF station to RAF station, back to home, out to the RAF stations, talking to young men who were going out to die, to give them some form of hope that that was not final, some understanding of God himself, and how their potential death that evening was not the end of them. Things like that. Mm-hmm. And this came to the notice of the people at the BBC in London. And the bosses there decided that this would be a great chap to do some lectures to raise the morale of the entire nation on radio. So they asked Jack if he would do it. And he did, for quite a long time, go up to the BBC in London under the bombs, sit in a studio, and address the nation. Very few of those, if any of them, were ever recorded. In those days, you didn't do that.
Amazing.
But Jack would sit there with something he'd written during the week, and he'd go up there and deliver it on the radio. And the extraordinary thing was that Jack's talent was such that people from all walks of life, farm laborers, fishermen, bricklayers, academics, would stop what they were doing all over England when C.S. Lewis came on the radio and listen. I was talking to a guy many years later whose name was Clifford Morris. He was a chauffeur driver with his own car. He came and picked you up and took your place. He used to drive Jack around, and me as well. And he told me of one time he was coming back from doing a delivery, dropped off his passenger somewhere, and stopped for lunch at a working men's pub in some village. And it was the public bar was full of labourers and farmhands and so forth, who were all rowdy, having a rowdy lunch there, and talking away 19 to the dozen. Suddenly the bartender, the publican, shouted, "Stop, stop, shh, quiet everybody. You have to listen to this chap. He's worth it." Turned on the radio, and over the airwaves came one of Jack's addresses, and there was a dead silence in the whole pub until he finished speaking. And then there was a quiet resumption of conversation building slowly up. All of these people stopped what they were doing and talking to listen to Jack because they felt he was worth it. That was the very beginning of his career in that kind of work. And later, when the scripts were sort of all ready and finished with, somebody suggested this would make a great book to publish. And the first one, I think, was called Broadcast Talks. Hmm. It was only a tiny, thin little book. But later he put them all together in three volumes. They were released, I think, three or four. And later all together in the one book of Mere Christianity. But they started as Balm for a Bleeding Nation.
Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership program offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up...
If you were around Lewis, you didn't go for a few minutes without having some sort of laugh or joyfulness.
The Christian life as C.S. Lewis thought it ought to be lived. Our special edition of the Christian Outlook will be back in a moment. Stay with us. Welcome back to a special edition of the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom, appreciating the life and legacy and the literary contribution of C.S. Lewis. I'm your host, Don Crow. We must lay before God what is in us, not what ought to be in us. That practical insight on prayer came from one of C.S. Lewis' later works, a work that might be somewhat less familiar to many readers of Lewis, Letters to Malcolm, chiefly on prayer. It was written later in his life, and thus serves as a window of sorts into Lewis's spiritual journey. Devin Brown set out to capture the spiritual biography of Lewis in his 2013 release, A Life Observed, A Spiritual Biography of C.S. Lewis. He was a guest of John Hall and Kathy Emmons on The Word FM in Pittsburgh.
Douglas Gresham, in your book, Devin, says that he's the only living person who actually lived with C.S. Lewis. So he ought to know, right? Talk about your association with Douglas Gresham.
Well, look, Douglas Gresham, if people saw Shadowlands, the Anthony Hopkins, Deborah Winger movie,
yes,
the little boy that comes, is Douglas Gresham in the movie, right? And a lot of people know him through that. He is Lewis's stepson. His mom married C.S. Lewis, and that amazing story how she got cancer and got sick and then got better and then finally passed away. Anyway, he was the boy in that great story, and Lewis was his stepfather. After Lewis passed away 50 years ago, as you mentioned, he and his brother, who was older and wasn't around nearly as much, became the heirs to Lewis. Lewis had a brother who died, Warney, who died in 73. But after 73, these two brothers who were stepsons, became the heirs. And Douglas Gresham was very involved in the Lewis company. He was the producer for the three Narnia films. So after I finished my biography, I thought, well, it'd be nice to have a foreword, and who better to ask to write it than Douglas Gresham himself? Mm-hmm. And I'd met him twice. So I wrote him, "Dear Mr. Gresham," right? You probably don't remember me. We've met twice, you know. And I said, "I've got this biography." And he was very cautious at first, and probably rightly so. He must get a million of nutty requests, people asking for a foreword. But
sure,
he was gracious enough to let me email it to him, and he began reading it. I will tell your audience this. He had a few very good suggestions for making my portrait of his stepfather a little bit more accurate, which I thank him for. And in the end, he wrote a very gracious foreword endorsing my book. So I couldn't thank him enough.
Wonderful. So, Devin, let's talk about C.S. Lewis. In Letters to Malcolm, a lot of people have read this. He talks a lot about his prayer life.
Yes.
Now, you would imagine, you know, that an atheist, what that would be like for someone coming to faith later in life, the difficulty, I guess, for some people to be able to fully embrace prayer. What about C.S. Lewis's prayer life?
Yeah, and that's a great question. So Lewis... And I'm sure there must be many young people today. They're sort of left on their own without much adult guidance in his spiritual life. Yeah, his parents sort of dragged him to church, and they kind of went through the motions. But he had this time in his youth where he tried to manufacture the proper feeling when he was praying, you know, and drum up this kind of faith. And he does say, I bet you a lot of young people do it. And no one kind of said no. And, it, you know, he goes by the name Jack. No, Jack, that's really not – you don't have to do all that. You don't have to really do anything other than ask God. Anyway, he went down some very bad paths as far as prayer went, which is part of the reason that he abandoned his childhood faith. He said it just didn't work, and it was too hard, and it was made no sense because he just didn't have much guidance. So, of course, later in life, I think a lot of his work came out to try and say, gosh, I was left so on my own with so little guidance. I'm going to give whatever guidance I can, and, you know, whether it's Mere Christianity or the very last book he wrote about that kind of thing, Letters to Malcolm, chiefly on prayer. And his own view was probably different than most of your listeners in that as a committed atheist, right, his first prayers were probably different than ours because the idea of even talking to this being that we now call God, he had to think a fair bit about it. But eventually he got it worked out, and I think he has some very great, great insights on prayer. It's a great book. And by the way, I think it's one of his lesser-known great books. Mm-hmm. Everybody thinks of the Narnia books or Mere Christianity, but you're right, Letters to Malcolm, chiefly on prayer, is a fantastic one. One of the things that the public doesn't know, and probably the greatest thing that I've learned from Lewis, and I've learned lots of things from studying him for the last 15, 20 years, is that as Christians, we just need to laugh more. The battle's already been fought and won, and we may not realize it, but you know, the victory is ours, and we should be full of joy. And I tell you where you get it. In the Narnia books, in the Narnia films, they're laughing and they're merry all the time. Every time Doug Gresham speaks, the first thing he says is that if you were around Lewis, you didn't go for a few minutes without having some sort of laugh or joyfulness.
Really?
And, man, that's something for all of us to remember.
It is difficult to talk about C.S. Lewis for any length of time without another formative literary figure from the 20th century also coming up, that of J.R.R. Tolkien. And it would be hard to overstate the significance of the relationship between these two men and the indebtedness of each of them to the other. Simply put, we don't get Lewis without Tolkien, and we don't get Tolkien without Lewis. And we don't get either of them without the great conflagration of their early years, the Great War, or World War I. LeConte talked about the friendship of these two men with Eric Metaxas.
Tell us about this book by Joe LaConte.
Thanks so much, Eric. Great to be with you. You know, I got interested in the idea for this book when I read a biography of J.R.R. Tolkien for the first time, and I realized that he had fought in the First World War at the Battle of the Somme, which is one of the bloodiest battles in the war. I had known that C.S. Lewis fought in the First World War, and then when I learned Tolkien had fought as well, I'm thinking to myself, here are these two men. They survived the trenches of World War I. They meet at Oxford. They become friends, and then they go on to write these epic tales of heroism where war is at the center of the thing. So you start to think, huh, I wonder if World War I was a formative influence on these two young men, and that has given me a deeper appreciation for what they accomplished, because think about the generation of men who came out of the First World War, men and women, and then the 1920s and 30s. This is a post-war mood of disillusionment, of gloom, and moral cynicism. And here you have these two men who come out of that conflict, that conflagration, and they don't have that reaction at the end of the day. And their works, are, in a sense, are pushing back.
And now, let's be clear. Lewis was initially cynical, but in part because of the friendship of his friend, what did he call him? Tolkien? Tollers?
Tollers.
Tollers, yeah. Jack and Tollers. Because of the friendship of his buddy, Lewis was able to turn the corner to find faith, and these two men end up creating some of the greatest literature of the century.
Yeah, that's a wonderful part of the story, actually, their friendship, of course, because Lewis is an atheist going into the war.
Yeah.
He is an atheist in a foxhole, and he comes out an atheist. But, you know, there are these wonderful moments when you read Lewis's journals, his letters, you see the grace of God in his life over time. So there's this wonderful letter he writes to one of his friends. This is after he's been wounded.
Yeah.
1918, he's been wounded in three places, and now he's recovering, hospital bed. They're sending him on a train to another place to recover, and he writes this letter, and he talks about the beauty of the English countryside, how he'd never really seen anything like it, and how he began to wonder if there might be a source of that beauty outside of us, a transcendent source of that beauty, that it just doesn't exist kind of in a materialistic world, but there's something outside of us that produces that beauty. It's one of those moments.
I forgot that. You're right. He's 20 years old. Yeah. First of all, it shows you what a mind and what a soul he had to be 20 years old to be having these thoughts.
Yes.
But you can't help wonder, is there something beyond this? Is there a source of this? And that's, of course, it becomes a huge theme for C.S. Lewis.
Yes.
But it was his friendship with Tolkien, the great Tolkien, that really drew it was God's way of drawing this out of Lewis or guiding Lewis on his path.
Yeah, I mean, Lewis describes Tolkien as the immediate human cause of his conversion to Christianity.
The immediate human cause.
I think that's pretty close to the exact quote.
I want to talk to you for a moment about ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Now, you've seen how your freedom's under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and for generations to come. Go to ChristianOutlook.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure that the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Coming up, we'll go to Narnia.
And it was a great privilege to have his bedroom as my bedroom and his study as my study. Then it occurred to me, this story was probably written in this room.
When our special edition of the Christian Outlook returns, stay with us. Welcome back to a special edition of the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Don Crow. C.S. Lewis is, in many respects, a gift to the Christian world that just keeps on giving. He died in 1963, and he is a bigger name today than at the time of his passing. His very popular Chronicles of Narnia series has seen a number of adaptations to the big screen, particularly popular among children. But are they really just children's books? I think you'll enjoy this next conversation. My colleague Eric Metaxas took his program and his Socrates in the City interview series to Oxford, England, where he interviewed Lewis scholar Michael Ward. They talked about Ward's genuinely groundbreaking work chronicled in Planet Narnia.
Where were you in life? When was it? Tell us what you can of the story.
Well, I think it probably is best to go back to the beginning and start with the fact that the Narnia books were read aloud to me by my parents when I was growing up. And that introduced me to the series and engendered in me a great enthusiasm for them. I love them as stories.
Read aloud to you. That is wonderful.
Yes.
So very early on, You cut your teeth, so to speak, on Narnia.
And I was intrigued by them, particularly because my parents just led me a little bit to realize that there was a kind of second level of meaning going on in the books.
Your parents? This, I've not heard this.
They said to me that, you know, Aslan is a little bit like Jesus.
Oh, okay.
And the White Witch is a little bit like the devil. You know, that was, it was no more than that. But that was enough to make me think of the Narnia books as different from other books, because other books didn't seem to have those two levels. And that led me on to read Lewis's other fiction when I was older, and I went through his Christian apologetics in my teens. Then I came here to Oxford to study English and began looking at Lewis's academic works. And then, when it came time for me to do my PhD, the obvious choice was C.S. Lewis, because I was already fairly expert in his writings. And then I began to teach. I began to tutor and lecture on Lewis, even before I began my PhD.
Okay.
And I lived for 3 years in his house.
You lived for 3 years in the kiln. So you clearly, you really had a deep connection with Lewis.
I did. And it was a great privilege in those 3 years living in the kilns, actually, to have his bedroom as my bedroom and his study as my study. There was one particularly interesting moment. I was sitting in his study one day, and I was listening to the BBC radio broadcasting an adaptation of one of the Narnia books, The Silver Chair. And then it occurred to me, this story was probably written in this room. And here it is being beamed back into the room. It goes out into the world, becomes famous, becomes a radio play, and gets beamed back into the room, and the circle is completed.
So then you get your PhD...
From St. Andrews.
From St. Andrews in Lewis studies?
I was looking at... Well, I began by studying his understanding of the word. That was my sort of provisional title. And I was going to look at his understanding of Christ, the divine word, scripture, the written word of God, and human language. And that gave me Christ, scripture, language, CSL, which I thought was really clever. But 18 months into the research, I was lying in bed one night reading a poem that Lewis wrote about the planets. The poem is simply The Planets. This is a poem that he wrote 15 years before Narnia. It's in a very complicated alliterative meter. And it's all about the seven planets of the medieval cosmos, which were the moon and the sun. They were regarded as planets: Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn.
Right. This is because in the medieval time, they could see those seven objects with the naked eye.
Yeah. So this is before the invention of the telescope. This goes back to time immemorial. This is, of course, before the discovery of Uranus or Neptune or Pluto. These are the seven traditional heavens, which in fact give us the names of the days of the week.
Were the ancient Greeks aware of these seven planets?
Oh, yeah. The ancient Babylonians.
Okay,
you know.
So it goes way back. But Lewis was a medieval scholar, so he wrote a poem about...
He did. Because as the generations went by, as the centuries passed, these seven objects in the sky became associated with all sorts of qualities and attributes and characteristics
This is where I get excited, because I'm assuming that most of us don't know anything about this. And that's why when I discovered this, I thought, this is so rich and so amazing because no one knows anything about it. So you have to be Michael Ward, a C.S. Lewis scholar, that you know just enough so that when you're reading this poem, something comes alive. And this idea that each of these seven planets in the medieval time, each of them had a sort of a whole poetic life.
That's right, a whole poetic set of qualities and symbolic attributes. And indeed, it was thought influences. That they would shed upon the Earth.
So give us an example of one or two.
Well, the moon is a famous example, because the moon is associated principally with lunacy.
So lunar
makes you a lunatic.
Right.
Lunacy. So when the moon is bright and full, people go mad. And why is the moon associated with madness? Because, mostly I think, because the moon is very changeable. You know, the moon waxes and wanes. The moon moves about very quickly. The moon sometimes changes color. It sometimes looks red. It sometimes looks blue. It's sometimes huge. It's sometimes small. So all this sort of variety and changeableness in the moon began to be associated with people's changeable mental states.
Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who impact public policy and serve in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up...
The more I look, the more Jupiter symbolism seems to account for the whole of the lion, the witch, and the wardrobe.
More with Eric Metaxas with Michael Ward when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Don Crow. So, many people in reading the Narnia series may have appreciated the profundity of the worlds he created and the power of his unique sort of fantasy literature. Some sense that there was something more. In this case, they were right. The Sun, the Moon, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn all have their corresponding Narnia book. And yet, we missed it. Or, more importantly, the Lewis scholars and the devoted admirers of Lewis missed it. Let's return to Michael Ward with Eric Metaxas and their interview recorded in front of a live audience in Oxford, England.
So all this sort of variety and changeableness in the moon was began to be associated with people's changeable mental states.
Right.
So a lunatic is under the influence of Luna.
Right.
Likewise, if you're particularly martial, strong, manly, then you're under the influence of Mars.
Mars.
You know, the god of war.
Right. I mean, I love these etymological connections. Venus, obviously the planet of love, feminine, love. I mean,
there's a good etymology there, because to venerate is to lovingly respect someone, and that's a Venus influence.
I didn't know that.
A venereal disease is something you contract under the influence of Venus.
This is a family show. So, please, enough. Lewis, he's steeped in this seven-planet cosmology. He's thinking about Jupiter, Jove, Jovial. Mm. He's thinking of Saturn, Saturnine. He's thinking, this is, and there's so much more to each one of them. Mercury, to be mercurial.
Yes.
And obviously, when you think of Mercury, the actual element,
Quicksilver, yeah,
it is itself mercurial, and it,
yeah.
So there's so much here. Okay, so this is the background.
Yep, and it's not just a medieval thing either. Of course, you know, it has roots in classical literature, classical mythology too, which Lewis equally was well steeped in. So he's writing this poem about the planets, and he's giving you a very poetic, beautiful description of each of the seven heavens, going out from Earth all the way up to heaven itself, God's home, which is outside their created order altogether. And I'm reading the lines about Jupiter. It's 11:30 at night, one Wednesday in February, 2003.
What year is this?
2003. Yeah, and I get to these lines about Jupiter, and one of the things that Jupiter is said to bring about is this: winter past and guilt forgiven. That's a jovial influence.
Okay, so we'll say this again. So we're talking about Jupiter, you're reading the planets,
yep.
And he says that Jupiter,
symbolically speaking, one of the things he's associated with is winter past and guilt forgiven.
Okay, and in American, that would be winter past and guilt forgiven. So you read this at 11:30 at night, and it hits you, it strikes you.
Yes, just those five words, winter past and guilt forgiven. Because I'm immediately put in mind of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Right.
Which is all about a magical kingdom where there's a 100-year winter, an accursed winter brought about by the White Witch. She's made it always winter, but never Christmas. And her winter passes at the coming of the king of Narnia, who's this lion called Aslan. So the passing of winter is a central symbolic shift of the first Narnia book. And it's also largely about the forgiving of guilt, this story. Because one of the children, Edmund, he's betrayed his brother and his sisters. He's guilty. He's entrapped by the White Witch. She's going to make him her slave. She's threatening to cut his throat. And suddenly he's rescued and he's forgiven. So I think winter past and guilt forgiven is a kind of effective five-word summary of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. So I look more closely at these lines about Jupiter in the poem.
Yeah.
And the more I look, the more Jupiter symbolism seems to account for the whole of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Okay, so when this strikes you at 11:30 p.m., now it's probably a few minutes after that, what additionally is going through your mind? Are you allowing yourself to move in the direction that I wonder if this is a code to these books?
Yeah, because as soon as I see this connection between Jupiter and the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, I then think, you know, my mind slowly grinding. There are another six planets, and there are another six books. Is it possible that they all correspond in this beautifully neat way? And it was very easy to see that they did.
Very easy for you, obviously, because you're very familiar with the books.
Yes.
And yeah.
Yeah.
But this is what's so delicious to me about this, is that I read the planets. It didn't occur to me.
No.
Many people have read the planets. You have to be a certain kind of person to appreciate this, and you were just teed up perfectly to be able to get it.
Well, I myself had read that poem many times before without making the same connection. So you're quite right. I was teed up. I was in just the right angle at just the right time of day.
That's the St. Andrews reference, teed up.
Yes,
yeah.
I think the home of golf, yes. And it was hole in one.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it really was, because I cannot imagine what it felt like to have this begin to dawn on you. What in the world is going through your mind? Because this is, I mean, I've said this is the greatest literary discovery of, I mean, it is. The idea that this was hidden from the world, that Lewis, and we have to talk about this, but the fact that Lewis did not reveal this, he didn't give the clue to a friend, or he said nothing. And all these years later, you're in bed reading this poem, and you think,
got it.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
I think I got it.
Yeah.
What is going through your mind? I mean, when did you get to sleep?
Well, I ought to explain a little bit more about why this thought occurred to me. And it was in no small part because I had been perplexed by the Narnia Chronicles for at least since my undergraduate dissertation, when I was reading the books carefully and closely. I was paying attention to them from a kind of scholarly point of view, literary critical point of view, and I was beginning to think to myself, these books are very disparate. There doesn't seem to be a uniform pattern or an obvious coherent design.
That's a great point, because many people have noticed that. I mean, I've noticed that. They feel they're similar and not similar. It's strange, and it's not just because they're about different things. They sort of feel slightly different.
Yes.
Typically, when one reads a series, they are absolutely of one piece.
Yeah. You read Harry Potter, and all seven books seem to fit pretty well into the same sort of form and expectation.
And that's true of all series, but it's not really true of the Narnia books.
I want to talk to you for a moment about ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Now, you've seen how your freedom's under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and for generations to come. Go to ChristianOutlook.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure that the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Coming up,
the character sleeping in the underground cavern is described as the god Saturn.
Wow.
It's there in the typescript three times.
A few more minutes with Michael Ward. The Christian Outlook returns in a moment for the final segment. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. It's not at all strange that another scholar would release another book about C.S. Lewis. That, in a sense, is just to be expected. But to genuinely discover a secret imaginative key within Lewis's work, something all the others have just missed? Now that is extraordinary. Let's return for just a few more minutes of Michael Ward with Eric Metaxas from Oxford, England.
These layers of meaning, and it's very helpful to hear this, because my first question when I heard about this discovery, even before I read the book, was how is it possible that decades could go by and that no one would know about this? Because what that implies, obviously, is that Lewis put this in there and never told anyone about it. Mm. And that, to me, is just bizarre. The idea that he could put layers of meaning, that each of these seven books has a separate atmosphere corresponding to one of these seven planets. And by the way, we've got to go down the list, right? The Dawn Treader is all about gold, the sun, it's about the sun.
Silver chair is the moon.
The silver chair, silver, it's about the moon, lunacy. I forget which is Venus.
The magician's nephew, all about creativity and beauty and mothers and golden apples and laughter.
Golden apples.
Sweetness.
Right.
All that constellation of qualities.
The horse and his boy is Mercury.
Yep, all about twins and language and running and boxing and theft.
And what is Saturn?
That's the last battle.
The last
battle. Which is all about the last times, death and disaster and treachery and Father Time.
The silver chair and Jupiter I can get, but the Saturnine qualities of the last battle, that doesn't strike me as obvious as the other two. I mean, that's...
No, but the point is that there were other people who were looking
along... But that's amazing to me that somebody noticed that.
They were looking along similar lines.
What's the most striking thing in the last battle that's Saturnine? Because I'm not remembering the details of what...
Well, the most obvious aspect, I suppose, is the fact that Narnia is brought to an end by Father Time. Now, if you read Lewis's scholarly works, you will see him say there, Father Time is based on earlier pictures of Saturn. So Father Time with his scythe, his sickle, and his hourglass, that's mythologically the same character as Saturn. And in fact, I discovered this. This was a marvelous kind of confirmation of the discovery. In the Bodleian Library here in Oxford, there is a manuscript of the silver chair, which is where Father Time is introduced.
Yeah.
He doesn't do anything in the silver chair. He's just shown sleeping. But in the typescript of the silver chair, the character sleeping in the underground cavern is described as the god Saturn.
Wow.
It's there in the typescript three times.
Wow.
But by the time he came to publish the silver chair, he thought, this is making it far too obvious. Let's call this character Father Time.
And yeah, I don't want somebody to discover this in my lifetime.
Yeah, let's bank on people not knowing that Father Time and Saturn are the same character.
That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. If you'd like to get the full conversation of Michael Ward with Eric Metaxas, please go to ChristianOutlook.com. And while you're there, take a moment to sign up for our podcast. And let me say thanks once more to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards and David Posian and Michael Cook, I'm Don Crow. Join us again next time for the Christian Outlook.